17 seconds in counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines on.
To go to the moon. 30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down.
Not because they are easy, but because they are
four
hard.
Forward.
Because
four forward, drift into the right level.
Serve to organize and measure the best.
30 seconds forward.
Energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept. One we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Air control both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Today's guest on Cosmic Perspective entered the Society of Jesus in 1989, was assigned as an astronomer to the Vatican Observatory in 1991, is a research and planetary scientist, curator of the Vatican Meteorite Collection, one of the largest in the world, located in the Pope's summer home in Castel Gandolfo. Brother Guy Consolmagno, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Today we're going to discuss intriguing visitors from afar, comets. There's evidence as far back as 300 BC that the Chinese track comets for several previous centuries. Brother Guy, what are comets and where do they come from?
Well, when you ask what is a comet, there's two different questions. What is it that you see in the sky? What was it that the Chinese saw? And, you know, most people have not seen comets. Comets that are bright enough to be seen come along maybe once every 10 or 20 years on average. What they are bright things in the sky that, unlike the moon or a star, move quickly, relatively speaking, from night to night. It's not like they flash across the sky like a meteor, but you see them in one part of the sky one night, and you'll see them in a distinctly different part of the sky the next night. They're not star-like, but they look like fuzzy bits of light. And if the night's good and dark, like it was in ancient times, you can actually see that they have a tail. So there is a streak of light that streams out away from the bright point that makes up the comet. And it's, of course, that tail that makes them very visible. So the question for thousands of years was, what were these things? You try to explain them in terms of the cosmology of the day, and people had very different ideas of how the universe was put together back then. So they were very puzzling because they were hard to fit into what people's ideas of the universe were. One of the things that a lot of people wondered about is, you know, if the planets control our fate, because, you know, astrology was very popular then, what's the role of comets? Generally, because comets came in a completely unpredictable way, as opposed to the planets, where eventually you could predict where they were going to be and what, you know, constellation you'd find them in from month to month, they were very frightening and often had the reputation of being a portent of something bad happening, something terrible. But people really didn't know what they were. Even as late as the time of Galileo, there was a great debate about what comets were. Now, Galileo had the idea, going back, you know, easily to Copernicus, but really an idea that went back to the ancient Greeks, that you could explain the motions of planets by saying they were going in circles around the sun. Comets don't fit, because the motion of a comet can't be explained as a circular motion around the sun. Galileo's answer was, comets are just things in the upper atmosphere, refractions of light like a rainbow. They're not really things in outer space. Because to accept that there are things in outer space made him have to accept that the simple Copernicus model of things going around the sun in circles couldn't be correct. Of course, we now know things don't go around in circles, they go around in ellipses. The great breakthrough of Halley and what made Halley's comet famous was not just that he was able to predict its return, but he was able to make that prediction because he understood Kepler's idea of elliptical orbits, not circular orbits. It's something Galileo didn't have. And as a result, we now know that comets are things out in space that have orbits that carry them far beyond the most distant planet we know of, and then have them come in once every comet orbit, which could be once every 100 years, once every 1,000 years, once every million years, to a path that brings them very close to the sun. The next question then was, all right, what are those tails? The thing that everybody recognized was that the tails always point away from the sun, not necessarily streaming out behind where the comet was moving. After the comet had gone past the sun, as it's moving out, the tail is also sticking outwards. So clearly something from the sun is pushing the tail back, but what was the tail made out of? Lots of theories. I won't go into all of them. Some of them are really crazy. But in 1950, there were two wonderful advances in our understanding of comets. The first was by a guy named Fred Whipple, who was an astronomer at Harvard, who was still there when I was a postdoc at Harvard in the 1970s, 1980s. A great, wonderful old guy by then. But in 1950, Fred Whipple noticed something else about comets, especially Comet Encke, which is a comet that goes around the sun about once every 3 years. It's very, very close to the sun. And Comet Encke doesn't exactly follow Kepler's laws. Its period shifts by a couple of days every orbit. And you go, what's going on there? Why, you know, why doesn't it follow the laws of gravity? Whipple said it does this because there are jets of gas spewing off the comet. Where does the gas come from? It must come from the comet. What is it made of before it becomes gas? It must be frozen ice. Ah, comets are collections of frozen ice and dust. And the ice gets turned into gas when the comet comes close to the sun. That's why they have a tail. In fact, that's why they have two tails. Some comets you can see, a gas tail or an ion tail, which moves in one direction directly out away from the sun, and then another tail, which we now know is dust, that has a very curved shape because it does get left behind as the comet moves, but it also gets pushed out away by the sunlight. So the dirty snowball model comes up in 1950. First idea, that's what a comet is. The same year, a Dutchman, Jan Oort, comes up with another. I hope you're expecting all of this explanation, but it's just, it's such a great story. Yeah. Jan Oort starts studying the comets that he can measure their orbits really carefully. And he realizes comets are not coming out from interstellar space. They are exactly in elliptical orbits. Even the longest period comets will return, but once every million years. And he says, wait a minute. If a comet's in an elliptical orbit, it spends most of its time, 999,999 years out farther than we can see it. And then for a period of about 1 year, it comes close enough that we can see it. And you see maybe one of these comets every year. Well, if you see one a year, but you only see a given comet 1 year out of a million, that means out there where we can't see them, there ought to be at least a million comets. And the comets come in from every direction, north, south, above the sun, below the sun, not just in the plane where the planets are. So this must be a cloud of comets, almost like a sphere surrounding the sun. So he came up with what we now call the Oort cloud. Still our best explanation of where the comets live, but we've never actually seen the comets in the Oort cloud. We only see them when they come close to us.
When were comets first observed through telescopes?
Well, of course, the first person to make a telescope that could see things in the sky with Galileo. He wasn't the first to make the telescope, but he was the first one to have a telescope good enough that you could see interesting things in the sky. A fellow named Thomas Harriot had one about the same time in England. So we're talking 1609. But of course, in order to see a comet in a telescope, you have to wait for the comet to come along. And there hadn't been a comet visible to the naked eye for more than 30 years at that point. The first comets that could be seen with a telescope were three different comets that all arrived in the year 1618. And Galileo, who was not in good health, was sick in bed when those occurred, so he didn't see them. The first guy to see them was a Jesuit priest, a member of the same order that I belong to, named Orazio Grassi. And he wrote a little booklet about the comets that he saw in 1619. He observed them the same time as another Jesuit priest, who was also an astronomer working up in Germany, and they measured the comet passing by nearby stars exactly the same distance, exactly the same time at night, which meant they did not see a parallax. The comet was so far away that you couldn't tell a change in its position, whether you were in Italy or in Germany. And this proved to them that the comet was out in space, not something in the upper atmosphere. Galileo didn't want to believe it, wrote a wonderfully sarcastic book making fun of these guys. Galileo's book says a lot of things that are true, but he gets the comet bit wrong. When Grassi wrote his book describing the motion of the comet, he makes a very obscure reference to people who don't understand optics. He thinks he's a friend of Galileo at that point. He thinks he's criticizing Galileo's enemies. But Galileo himself, as far as I can see, misread what Grassi was saying. Grassi wasn't clear enough. Galileo took it as an insult against him, and that started the whole, you know, controversy that spun totally out of control. You know, once people understood that you could make telescopes and see things through telescopes, everybody wanted to look. Galileo was very jealous of being the first to see all these things. Didn't like the idea that other people could see things as well as he could.
But later in the 19th century, Schiaparelli made a major discovery in our understanding of what comets are and their orbits.
The real question of what is a comet still remained. You know, you can see them through the telescope, but they're still just fuzzy blobs of light. Nobody's telescope then, even nobody's telescope today, is quite good enough to see detail on the surface of a comet nucleus. But Schiaparelli noticed an interesting fact. Along with comets, when you look in the nighttime sky, you also see showers of meteors. And the showers of meteors occur on basically the same night or couple of nights every year. What the heck is a shower of meteors? You can see the strings of light in the sky. You know what a meteor is in terms of what you see, but what are they made out of? Schiaparelli recognized that they're probably bits of dust. Bits of dust in space that hit the upper atmosphere and burn up as they go through the atmosphere. That gives you the flash of light. But why do they always come in the same day? Well, that would be the case if the Earth, in its orbit around the sun, was going through a cloud of this dust. Now, these showers can be periodic, and like the Leonid shower, every 33 years is really bright. Schiaparelli could tell where the shower was by the direction that the dust seems to come when it hits the Earth's atmosphere. He could tell where it was in space by the fact that the Earth was going through it on the same day every year, in the same part of the Earth's orbit every year. And the fact that it came every 33 years told him that there was a cloud of dust that was especially strong every 33 years. He was able to use his math to work out the orbit of that cloud of dust. If you have dust is in space, it's got to be an orbit around the sun, or else it'll fall into the sun. He could work out the orbit, he could work out the shape of the orbit, he could work out the period of the orbit, and he saw that it exactly matched the period of a well-known comet. That comet turned out to be Comet Temple-Tuttle, and this was the first indication that dust streams and comets are related. Schiaparelli thought that comets were formed as the dust streams coagulated, but in fact now we know that the dust comes off of the comet.
As you mentioned before, Fred Whipple's 20th century observations helped him theorize that comets were dirty snowballs. That was another major contribution of our understanding of comets.
That also tells us the other composition that goes into them. Not only do you have the dust, and we can figure out what the dust is made out of by looking at the dust that hits our atmosphere, but you have the ices. And ices that turn into ions or gases can be measured with telescopes using spectra. So between those two things, we've got a pretty good idea of what chemicals are actually present in comets. It's mostly water ice, mostly dust like you would find in meteorites, but lots of other traces of organic chemicals as well, things like methane and ethane and a whole string of more complicated chemicals.
And now we know that through observations in the 21st century that comets are not as dense as we once had expected. In fact, they're only about half as dense as water.
We now actually have been able to send spacecraft to these comets. And by seeing how much the mass of the comet deflects the path of the spacecraft, you can figure out how massive they are. And you can take a photograph to see how big they are. So the size divided by the mass gives you the density. Even before that, you had an idea they're pretty low density because it didn't take a whole lot of squirting of these jets coming off of them to move them around, so they couldn't have been particularly heavy. It turns out, in both cases, the density comes out to about half the density of water. But you go, wait a minute, they're made out of water. They're made out of water ice, and not just water, but also water and rock, about maybe half and half dust. So you would expect, if the rock has a density of 3 and the water has a density of 1 gram per cc, then the average density ought to be, you know, something around 2 grams per cc. In fact, the average density is a half a gram per cc. How is that possible? It's possible if the comets are 3/4 empty space. They're not solid chunks of ice. They're fluff.
Kind of like when you're walking through snow and you're kind of kicking it up in the air. It must be something like that.
It's not quite as fluffy as snow, but it's in the same ballpark, yeah.
Brother Guy, I know you've studied comet-like objects called centaurs. Can you tell us about your observations and what we believe makes centaurs different than comets?
Right. That great idea that comets come from an Oort cloud and they're made up of these primordial gases and ices and dust explains the long period comets, the ones that come once every million years. But as people collected comet data, they discovered there's a couple of hundred of them that come on shorter periods. And not only do they come in shorter periods, but they don't come from above or below the solar system. They're mostly in the plane of the solar system. And they're strongly perturbed by Jupiter because they pass by Jupiter being in the same plane, the same orbit, orbital plane as Jupiter. So they're called Jupiter family comets. And a number of these even look chemically a little bit different. Okay, so if there's a cloud 10,000 AU away for that, where the comets in the Oort cloud sit, what about these guys that have a period of a few hundred years? The far end of their orbits would be out beyond Neptune, trans-Neptunian objects. There ought to be a disk of material out beyond Neptune that these comets come from. Could you see that? For a long time, people looked. The only thing out there that matched it was Pluto. Pluto was too big to be the source of a comet. But finally in the 90s, a couple of people started looking for them, Dave Jewett and Jane Liu. And they found the first of what are now more than 1,000 objects that are out beyond Neptune, trans-Neptunian objects or Kuiper Belt objects, because Gerard Kuiper was one of the guys who suggested this disk. Well, you've got things out there. How do they get from out there to in here? What's the transition that moves them from the Kuiper Belt into becoming comets? Complicated celestial mechanics, complicated interactions with Neptune and other planets. And it turns out it doesn't happen all at once. There is a transitional period where for a while you can have an object that's in an orbit that's coming out of the trans-Neptunian region, crossing the orbit of Neptune, maybe crossing the orbit of Uranus, maybe even crossing the orbit of Saturn, and its orbits eventually get pumped more and more and more that eventually they come in closer than Jupiter. They get to be warm enough that the ice starts to boil away, and then they're comets. Well, what do you call them before they get to that state? At that point, they're sort of kind of like an asteroid, but you know they're going to be a comet. The joke goes, they're half comet, half asteroid. Well, they're half and half two different things. The first ones observed were given the names of centaurs, those Greek mythical creatures that were half horse and half man. And the centaurs are fascinating because they come close to us, close enough that we can observe them pretty well in our telescopes, but they tell us what's going on with the stuff that's further out, that's harder for us to observe. That's why we've been observing them with our little 2-meter telescope in Arizona. The centaurs are a way of getting a piece of something that's normally too far for us to see and observing it close up.
So centaurs eventually become comets.
Eventually they do. That's the idea. It may take thousands or tens of thousands of years before the orbits get tweaked enough that they actually start putting off gases.
By composition, what's the difference between a comet, a centaur, and an asteroid?
Oh, it would be very easy to explain if you'd asked me that question 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we thought we understood it perfectly. We said, asteroids are made out of rock. Comets are mostly made out of ice. Asteroids don't have tails. Comets do. Wouldn't you know, we've begun to discover asteroids in the asteroid belt with asteroid-type orbits that give off tails. And then we've got these centaurs that are in comet-like orbits but don't give off tails. We've discovered that Ceres, the biggest of the asteroids, or actually the smallest of the dwarf planets, depending on where you want to put it, probably has a density that suggests it's maybe half water, but it has a very dark surface. The world is a lot more complicated than we thought it was.
So even asteroids have a high concentration of water in them.
Some of them do.
Some do.
Some of them don't. The ones that are more likely to be rich in water are the ones found further out in the asteroid belt, but that's only a more likely case. There are some dark water-rich ones that come close to the Earth. Some people think that's where the Earth got its water. That's where the water from the oceans came from.
In 2005, the Deep Impact mission performed a scientific experiment on Comet Tempel 1. Would you explain to our listeners what happened during that experiment?
The comet was fairly small. They got some nice images of it. And then the spacecraft going by the comet launched a copper ball. They chose copper because copper is not an element that you normally see in comets. So they would know whatever they measured coming off, if it wasn't copper, came from the comet. The flash was so bright that they couldn't actually see the crater it made. It overwhelmed the camera. A few years later, a different spacecraft, the one that had gone to collect comet dust at Comet Vilt, was redirected to go by this comet to see if it could see the crater that Deep Impact had left. Just barely. You have to really have to squint your eyes and convince yourself you're seeing a crater there. It's such a tiny speck on the surface of this rather small comet. We've now had spacecraft that have gone to half a dozen different comets and given us some really good images of what their surfaces look like. And it's fascinating and frustrating because there are no two comets that look alike. Everyone's different. Everyone's got its own unique history. One of the interesting things about science, and you know, this is the scientific revolution came out of Galileo. Wow, we should be able to do experiments. We should be able to test our theories. If I observe something, you should be able to observe it too. The idea of repeatability is an important part of science, but comets throw this all out the window because no two comets are alike. If you observe something really weird in the comet and report it, I look at the next comet and I don't see it. That doesn't prove that you didn't. It just says that the two comets were different.
Now we have long-term comets and short-term comets, and the long-term comets come from the Oort cloud, we believe.
That's right.
Is that correct? And
that's
the short-term right. From the Kuiper belt, that's what we believe.
Well, pretty much, yeah. There are some that are even so short-term that they're very, very close to Jupiter, like Comet Encke. But even those probably evolved, had their orbits evolve in from the Kuiper belt, right.
And how many of these comets have we actually tracked or labeled? You know, how many are periodic?
You can find a website that's run by the Minor Planet Center at it's the Smithsonian Astrophysical Institute in Cambridge that keeps track of all of these. And I think the number of known periodic comets is still less than 200.
Wow. Out of thousands of comets that we've tracked.
Well, and there have maybe been 5,000 comets that people have talked about seeing over the history of the human race. And when you compare that against the number of asteroids that we know of, there are something like 500,000, half a million asteroids that we know of so well that we can work out their orbits, and probably 10 times as many small guys that we don't know yet.
That is amazing. And this is all stuff that was left over when the solar system formed, correct?
That's the idea. And that leads to the next wonderful thing that comes out of understanding comets and the connection between comet science and finding planets around other stars. The Oort cloud was made out of stuff that was formed as the planets were forming, probably stuff that was formed not too far from Jupiter. And Jupiter's gravity launched this bits of stuff out to where the Oort cloud is now in all sorts of different directions. That's what gravity interactions will do. Well, if all this stuff is being launched outward, that pulls Jupiter inwards, conservation of momentum. As Jupiter moved inwards, the latest models suggest that Jupiter would have gotten into a resonance with Saturn, jarred up Saturn's orbit so that it started moving the orbits of Neptune and Uranus and completely shifting the orbits of these giant planets back in the early solar system, back maybe 500 million years after the sun was formed, making these planets move and migrate an enormous amount. We see the echoes of that movement today. We see it in the bombardment of craters on the moon that dates from about half a billion years from the formation of the moon. And the idea that giant planets could move around so much fits in with the observations, the very surprising observations, that the planetary systems we see around other stars also have giant planets in orbits that aren't where you would have expected they would have been made. The other great thing is the Kuiper Belt, the Oort cloud, is very hard for us to see here from Earth. But that turns out to be some of the easiest stuff to see around another star, because it's far enough away from the star that it doesn't get lost in the starlight. So we've actually seen Kuiper belts, belts of dust, around other stars.
It almost sounds as if you had Jupiter in the middle of a mixing bowl, and you had all the other planets and stuff that was left over, and then you just turn this electric mixing bowl on and it all kind of scattered
that
away.
That is a brilliant, brilliant image. I've never heard anybody use the mixing bowl before, but I think I'll steal that and use it myself because that's exactly what it's like. And then, of course, like when you're making a cake batter, some of it goes flying out of the bowl entirely. I'm sure that happened too. And who knows, maybe some of the planets are full of chocolate chips.
Well, that's what we hope anyway, the Milky Way, right?
Oh, indeed.
Brother Guy, I'd like to talk to you a little bit now about Comet Ison. Comet Ison is visible through binoculars, but not as bright as was predicted.
The trouble is that Comet Ison is one of these long-period comets. This may be the first time it ever came close to the sun. So because it's full of ices other than water ice that boil away very easy, it got to be fairly bright fairly early on. And it's really hard to predict how its brightness is going to change as it comes closer to the sun. The most recent numbers I've heard suggest that while the gas is brightening up nicely, the dust isn't. The dust is not getting brighter, and we don't understand this, but as I say, every two comets are different. There was a comet much like this that people of our generation who have gray hair like you and me can remember. When I was a kid, when I was in college, when going to studying at MIT, all the excitement was Comet Kohoutek. Kohoutek was discovered well outside Jupiter, was already beginning to have a tail. It was going to be the comet of the century. By the time it actually approached the sun, it wasn't anything all that bright. So I remember I was home for Christmas. It was Christmas vacation. And in those days, the family lived in a house on the shore of Lake Huron. We had a window that faced due east over the lake. And I had read that the comet was going to be visible just after sunrise, or just before sunrise. So I got my little telescope out looking through the window, which you should never do, but what the heck, I gave it a try. Waiting for the comet, and there wasn't any comet. Waiting for the comet, the sky was getting brighter. Waiting for the comet, the sun was about to come up. I saw this wonderful crescent moon, but no comet. The sun rises. I look at the crescent moon, and I'm going, wait a minute. The crescent is curved in the wrong direction. I pulled my telescope out and looked, and in fact, that curve of light was the comet. Kohoutek could be seen with the naked eye. It just wasn't one of these spectacular knock-your-socks-off things. Well, that was, what, 1973. A few years later, I'm 1975, 76, March of 76. I'm a graduate student at the University of Arizona, living out in a couple of miles from campus in a really cheap rundown apartment with another grad student. And he says, oh, you've got to see this other comet. It's going to be Comet West. I'm going, yeah, I've seen comets. They're just little fuzzy things. Oh, no, you got to get up at 4 a.m. Yeah, I'm not going to get up at 4 a.m. to see it. Well, okay. So I was awake at 4 a.m, pulled on my blue jeans, walked outside, and there in the sky was Comet West. That looked like every photograph you've ever seen of a comet. It was huge. It was, I don't know, 20 degrees across. It was as bright as you know, a quarter moon. And it was the scariest thing I'd ever seen. And once I saw that, I understood why ancient people were terrified of comets. To see something that big, that bright, show up that suddenly, it wasn't there a week ago, wasn't there a couple of days later, out of the blue, in just such an eerie shape, that even knowing, even having studied comets, my heart started racing. And here it is, 40 years later. I'll never forget it. So you don't know. Is Comet Ison going to look like that? Is it going to be something like Kohoutek? It'll be something in between. We're not sure. We don't even know if it's going to survive the passage. Ison, if it's visible, should be best seen after perihelion. Perihelion is on Thanksgiving. So the days after Thanksgiving, look to the north, either right after sunset or right before sunrise. You might see a great comet. But Ison is going to be passing so close to the sun that it's possible it will break up and not even survive as a comet when it comes out the other side. We don't know. No two comets are alike. That's what makes it so much fun.
Yes. That's considered a sun-grazing comet, correct? Where it's going to come
right.
very
That's
close
what we
call to
them.
The sun. Yeah. Brother Guy, thank you very much for sharing with us today your experiences and your knowledge, the science that you've done on comets and centaurs and asteroids. Thanks for enlightening all of us. It was a very special time, and thanks for being on Cosmic Perspective.
Well, it's one thing to keep your cosmic perspective. The way to do that is to go outside and keep looking up.
That's what I tell everybody. Look up and wonder.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Cosmic Perspective is an Andy Panero's production. Thanks for listening to this 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.